Welcome to the Urology Coding and Reimbursement Podcast, where we help urologists and staff achieve peak economic and practice efficiency so there is time and energy to focus on patient care and a happy life. I'm your host, Scott Painter, with my co-hosts, Mark Painter and Dr. Ray Painter.
Today's episode is brought to you by ModMed. Do your EHR and PM adapt to your style of practice? The ModMed EHR and PM do, with benefits like remembering preferences and automatically suggesting documentation and billing codes. Urologists voted ModMed the number one urology-specific EHR and PM solution available, built by urologists with input from yours truly. Stop wasting 60 minutes and 200 for each of your open or no-show slot. Go to modmed.com/PRSnetwork. Set up an appointment with the team at ModMed Urology and shift your urology practice into high gear. Imagine a solution on a tablet or the web that works seamlessly with revenue cycle management, analytics, telehealth, payment processing, patient engagement tools, and much more. ModMed is transforming healthcare by placing doctors and patients at the center of care.
Welcome to episode 168 of the Urology Coding and Reimbursement Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Painter, with my co-host, Mark Painter, and special guest. We want to welcome back Dr. John Lin. Dr. Lin is a solo practitioner in Gilbert, Arizona, in the Phoenix area, and runs a group on Facebook that we all recommend that you join. It's the Thriving Urology Practice Facebook group. And John, I'll let you share a little bit about yourself and also tell them how to join the group if they haven't already.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to this amazing podcast. And thank you again for the opportunity to participate. I'm a solo practice urologist, kind of like doing what you all are doing, trying to educate urologists and my way to pay it forward, if you will. Urology has been extremely good to me, my family, my patients, and now it's my turn to pay it forward so we can share in the awesomeness of urology in general, and so that people are not working and spinning their wheels and feeling like they're a hamster just running the wheel and not making any progress. The Thriving Urology Practice Facebook group is one of the ways that I do this pay it forward, if you will, where we crowdsource practice management solutions for everyone's benefit, and it is all for free. And if you go to facebook.com/group/thrivingpractice, you'll be able to find it, or just look up Thriving Urology Practice. Today's questions come from the Facebook group. And the first one, Mark, if you're ready, I'll shoot this to you.
Sure.
Okay. In one of my probably over 15 or 16 videos that I've done in the group on Modifier 25, after I posted another one, which stemmed from a question asked by a member of the group, somebody responded in a comment and said, of course, you would only bill that Modifier 25 E&M visit if you did a cystoscopy and that Modifier 25 E&M was done in a separate room from the procedure room. So what do you think, Mark?
Well, there are no place of service restrictions for Modifier 25. You can use it in the hospital. You can use it in the office. You can use it in the ambulatory surgical center. And the reality is when Medicare sees a claim come in the door, they see the place of service. They don't see the room. So that's another piece that's out there. So that is not a restriction that is out there. You know, the reality of what you're doing is more to the point, right? That the Modifier 25 has to be significant and separately identifiable. The patient needs to be coherent, right? You can't have a patient interaction when the patient is still under the effects of anesthesia. So, you know, there are definitely some cases where it doesn't make sense to bill an E&M service following a procedure in an ambulatory surgical center where, you know, in the office, you wouldn't necessarily have that anesthesia side of the equation, but the rules are the same. As long as that patient is capable of participating in the visit and you are in fact, providing that, significant and separately identifiable service, location is not the issue. It's so documentation.
This is the question that she's asking. Really, the patient does a, for instance, a cystoscopy for gross hematuria. You find the urologist finds a tumor in the bladder, and then does the counseling, the findings, the implications, the treatment options, decision for a treatment option, does the consent process for a TURBT with immediate postoperative intravesical mitomycin C, and then schedules the patient for surgery. All of that is done in the procedure room. And I think her point that she's trying to make is, can we bill an E&M if the E&M service was done in the procedure room, the same room where the cystoscopy was performed?
Yes. That's a short answer. Yeah. I mean, there's no block there. Right. And you know, as part of that is you do get paid the facility rate, right? If you're in an ambulatory surgical center or an HOPD. So you get paid a little less because you don't get the non-facility rate of the office. But, you know, from an office flow perspective, time and value of money, it absolutely should be done. You're providing that care. You should be reporting it, and you should be getting paid for it. And unfortunately, I hear that a lot. There's a lot of folks that we've run into who have somehow translated all of this to, you can't do it. And yeah, you are going to get a few more of your records pulled and looked at for that. So one of the things I'm encouraging people to do with documentation now, with all of the computer-assisted coding tools that the insurance companies are using, is to add in a specific phrase like significant and separately identifiable E&M service provided on the same date as the procedure as follows, and then go through everything. So not just, you know, putting that information in, but actually highlighting that it's considered significant and separately identifiable.
Unfortunately, you really have to dumb it down for the computers and the payers when they audit your chart. Same thing with evaluation and management services in general. When it comes to E&M coding, I often will put in the phrase, this is an undiagnosed new problem for which there may be significant morbidity if left untreated and undiagnosed. Or this is a chronic problem that is worsening. Or this is a chronic stable problem, to make it abundantly clear to any auditor who may be reading the chart. Yep. So that sounds like the bottom line, and so I'll divert a little bit. I participate in a lot of photography forums on different social media platforms, and there's always somebody asking, well, how do I do this or how do I do that? And often it goes back to, you have to read the manual. If you really want the bottom line, if you really want the source of the information, the right information, unfortunately, you have to take the time to read the manual. If you read the definition for modifier 25, there's no stipulation regarding where that service may be provided, whether that is in a procedure room or in a separate exam room on the same day as the procedure. So the bottom line is, yes, you can bill for that modifier 25 E&M service if you meet the definition and criteria, even if the procedure is done in the procedure room where the cystoscopy or the CPT service was performed. So I've gotten a lot of questions about modifier 25, and I've never had someone make that mention. So I just want to bring that to the forefront so that everyone has a clear understanding. It's just amazing how many subtopics you can spin off of modifier 25.
I have a question for you, John, on this, on modifier 25, while we're on it. How many times do you think you bill modifier 25 in a week, a month? I don't know what time frame you want to pick, but, and is this scenario very common to you? This exact scenario, do you do this a lot?
I don't do this scenario a lot, meaning Okay, so this is an efficiency and workflow perspective. I actually have two procedure rooms, so this is not so much of a constraint for me, but I will do the procedure in the cystoscopy or the procedure suite, and I will briefly tell the patient the findings because it is on the screen and I'm telling him or her the findings as I'm doing the procedure. And then as soon as I'm done, I walk out of the room because the medical assistant is then directing the patient to go void, to get dressed, and then put the patient in an exam room, freeing up the procedure room so another procedure can be readied to be performed in that room. While the patient's voiding, getting dressed, I'm stepping out of the room to document whatever I did. So from an efficiency perspective, that's what I'm doing. Not only that, if the patient's taking a little bit longer, I can go on to see the next patient that's already roomed in one of the exam rooms. After the cystoscopy patient has been placed in a separate exam room, and after I've seen that next patient, I then go back to that cystoscopy patient to go over the findings, implications, the treatment options, and then finally deciding on a treatment, go over the informed consent process, and then scheduling the patient for any sort of a surgery that is needed, which is a significant and separately identifiable service that I physically performed. And of course, I will document separately on the encounter on the same day as cystoscopy. How often does this happen? Rarely, because as far as counseling the patient in the procedure room where I perform the procedure, I do it with the patient in the procedure room very seldomly because I want to make sure he or she is comfortable, has voided, gotten dressed, can speak to me in a dignified fashion instead of being half naked. So I commonly, most often, will have the patient in a separate room to provide that service, even though by definition, that is not necessary to bill for a modifier 25 visit.
And how many modifier 25s do you think you bill in a month, week?
That's a phenomenal question. As a matter of fact, yesterday I was doing a bunch of cystoscopies and then I'm scheduling these guys for some sort of a surgical intervention, or maybe just medical therapy. Every time I'm doing one of these, I'm thinking of everyone listening. How that when you know the rules, when you know how to document it, when you know how to provide it, I'm doing it multiple times a day. So conservatively, if you just think about this, conservatively, if I do two cystoscopies and then I schedule and I do a modifier 25 ENM on just two cystoscopies a day, and typically you're doing a surgery because, so first of all, why are you doing a cystoscopy? Typically, let's say for BPH, it's a chronic problem that is not a treatment goal. So from a ENM problem perspective, that's a level 4 problem, not a level 4 visit, level 4 problem. And then you choose a treatment option. So for instance, I'm going to recommend a TURP, for instance, which is easily a level 4 risk. So now I have a level 4 problem, a level 4 risk. So let's just say that I do two of these, which is a level 4 99214 established patient visit, $128 Medicare on average, not taking into account geographical adjustments. If you just do two of these a day, clinic day, and say that you work 3.5 days a week, 48 weeks a year, that's typically, you take a whole month off for vacation. That amounts to about $43,000 a year. That's a new Tesla every single year. That's a moderately well-appointed Ford F-150 a year, every single year. So it adds up. And yesterday, as I was doing these modified 25 visits, I'm thinking, okay, well, that's more than two. So it adds up. Appropriate modifier 25 use is the right thing to do if you provide the service and do the documentation and quit leaving money on the table.
And Mark, how often are you seeing this left on the table when you're visiting practices? Is this
quite frequently? There's a couple of things I think that are holding folks up. Number one, their documentation doesn't always match what they're doing, right? So it's it's not that it's just undercharged. It's underdocumented. I mean, you got to take the time to put the documentation in, because the modifier 25 is the most commonly abused modifier in the system. It gets a lot of scrutiny. It's going to require some work from your staff to submit medical records and follow those things up. So it's, you know, as we run these battles constantly and for our billing clients, you know, our team that is working the RCM is saying, man, can't you just schedule them differently? Because it would be a lot easier on them. But the bottom line is, you know, I keep going back and forth with them. It's like that is not an efficient use of time, nor the patient's time. Like everybody loses in that situation. And so, yes, it's a hassle. And unfortunately, a lot of the folks that submit modifier 25 documentation and don't have that documentation end up getting denied, leading often to the conclusion that modifier 25 doesn't work, so you should stop doing it, which is not the case. It's that there was a fail in the documentation, there was a fail in the communication, or there was a fail in the follow-up, and then that becomes institutionalized. And we've had groups that have just said, oh, you can't use modifier 25, which is crazy, unless you have a new diagnosis, which is wrong as well. So, and John, you mentioned the CPT manual and the definition of modifier 25, which is very clear in both of those circumstances that it's not place of service restricted or diagnosis restricted. But further than that, the Medicare carrier's manual instructs that same thing. You can dig down layers and find out that modifier 25 is there, but the fail rate on documentation is big. And that's why all of this keeps coming back to haunt folks, because you've got too many people who aren't taking the extra time to put the supporting documentation in their records.
And hence the question behind the question of this question.
Yes.
It's really learn the rules, right? It's not this question is a very specific question given a very specific scenario, but really it's a bigger answer, as you've heard.
Yeah. It's not knowing the rules, it's executing on the rules.
Yes.
That's the other piece I'll just add in right now is everybody now, or almost everybody, is on electronic medical records. And John brought up reading the manual on the rules. But the other thing you ought to really take a look at is how much your EHR can help you shortcut this stuff. There are dot phrases, there are click phrases, but whatever you've got, you need to leverage that EHR. You know, the burnout side of the equation, as everybody tries to struggle through their EHR, a big piece of it is they're not leveraging that tool as well as they should. I mean, it can help put those phrases into your document without fail and very easily do that. So it's building the routines, building your templates, building your shortcuts, and actually building that documentation so it supports what you actually did for that particular visit. It'll if you can get that efficiency down, and then your AR team can deal with it, and ultimately you can push the payers to focus on somebody else who's not doing the right thing. So it takes work, but that front end planning and that front end foundation is absolutely key.
So many points to make here. The last time the E&M rules were changed was back in 95, 97, and it took 20 some odd years before the new one came out in 2021. Yeah. For most people listening to this podcast, these rules will most likely continue to operate and be applicable throughout your entire practice career. So why not learn it once? Learn it, master it, so that you can continue practicing without feeling like, oh, why am I not getting paid appropriately? Why are these claims getting denied? And as far as you know, these EHRs and mastering and optimizing these EHRs and use any ancillary tools that may be available, for instance, voice recognition macros. It's kind of like, I think of it this way. It's kind of like buying a $5,000 camera body with a $12,000 400 millimeter f/2.8 lens. You have the stuff, but if you don't learn how to use it, you're not going to be any better than someone who's using a cell phone to take pictures. Just like if you were to buy a Bugatti or Lamborghini, if you never take a driving course, a race car driving course, you're going to be underutilizing the capabilities of that sports car. Granted, you're probably not going to use that on the surface streets, but on the racetrack. So there are, it's not just learning the rules, but the application of the rules. That's what really separates someone who is just struggling versus someone who's really, really thriving in a practice.
Yep. And the last piece I'll pile on to all this stuff is, you know, I've been doing a number of talks around the country recently, and one of the things that I keep bumping up against is the fact that everybody's just so busy. You know, appointments are way out. Nobody can find a new urology partner and they need one. APPs and staff is tough to get a hold of. I mean, bottom line, it's a people shortage. It's a shortage of support in all this. And it's not going to get any better. I was looking at the curves and the projections and everything that are out there in the marketplace. And our shortage of urologists, just given the demographics and the production of urologists or the schooling release of urologists, 2035 is when everything starts to turn around. So, and that's the start of the turnaround. We don't catch up till 2050. Given the current parameters of what's out there. And the one projection that we're already short of urologists, and it's going to get bigger. They said by 25, it's going to be as high as 3,600 urologists short. Now, that doesn't mean that the patients are going to stop having problems for urologists to treat. So you've got to look at how can I efficiently see my patients? How can I efficiently deal with this bolus of people that are going to need support as I deal with this? So putting things in the right spot, meaning having your staff support you as much as possible, treating your staff well so that you don't have that turnover, or acknowledging you're going to have that turnover and being able to quickly train your staff to, you know, new staff to do what you need them to do, and leveraging every tool from the automation side that you can, and that includes your EHR. All of those things are going to be parts of your life that if you can embrace them, you know, you can enjoy the practice of urology and financially survive and thrive.
Oh, that's just so heartbreaking to me. I was in Alabama giving a talk on a marketing and efficiently practice strategies for efficient practice in that last month. And one urologist came up to me and said, I'm ready to close my doors because he is not able to sustain his practice. And in talking with him, there are just brief conversation. There are several shortcomings, several things that he can change and really turn things around.
Yeah.
So that just frustrates me, saddens me.
Yeah. It's tough. It's, you know, ultimately we're going to have to adapt one way or another. We've got to keep looking and keep improving. You know, that constant improvement protocols that everyone needs to look at front to back.
Continuous process improvement, or also known as Kaizen, this Japanese word Kaizen, continuous process improvement or change good. It's human nature. Human nature to just stay the way we are, because change is difficult. Change takes work. Nobody likes change unless you're a baby with a dirty diaper. So change is difficult. But in medicine, I mean, I was just thinking about this today before I came on. And the way I do, even last night, I was doing cases, putting up a stent. The way that I put up a stent now is very different than how I was trained. The instruments that I use, the way I put up a female stand versus a male stand, it's totally different than how I was trained. The way I perform cystoscopies, flexible cystoscopies in the office, that has changed. The way I deal with BPH patients, that has changed. Same thing with coding and billing. The rules are constantly changing, and you're going to be covering that, Mark, at the upcoming Urology Advanced Coding and Reimbursement Seminar, two of which will be in Vegas in December and also in New Orleans in January, where you will cover some of those changes that are happening in 2024. And the way I think of it is that the payers, or the biggest payer, Medicare, CMS, they are changing the rules every single year. We, as urology practices, unfortunately have to react to these changes. And those practices that can pivot the fastest are the ones who are going to benefit.
Absolutely true.
Well, we have... Just let me add one more thing. You know, we have examples of not only are they changing every year, now we're starting to see them change, you know, monthly, weekly, where they're finding a little one of these rules. And a good example was the ICD-10 excludes rules, where they're now focusing on maybe one specific rule for one specific procedure, and they're starting to deny it. And unless you're there and proactive and can get that information, you're going to be way behind the eight ball and having all these claims denied before you figure it out. So getting all those little changes is what's becoming more and more important.
And I get it. It's frustrating as heck because a lot of you who are listening to this who are urologists, you spent 4 years in med school, 5 or 6 years in residency, and now I have to learn these stupid rules, stupid games that we have to play. Unfortunately, if you participate in this third-party payer scheme, you have to play by the rules. And if you understand the rules the best, you tend to be happier practicing because you're going to be paid expeditiously, right away, in the appropriate amounts for the work that you perform. And even though the amounts may be paltry, at least you're not leaving money on the table.
Yes.
should we move on to the second question?
Sure.
Yes.
I think we beat the first one to death. All right, second question. Blue Cross Blue Shield is not paying ICD-10 N52.9 for office visit E&M. What is the replacement code? And for those who have not memorized the entire ICD-10 table, N52.9 means male erectile dysfunction unspecified. Mark?
Yeah, so so that is a common denial. It's not just Blue Cross and Blue Shield. Erectile dysfunction is definitely one of those areas that isn't always part of the benefit package. If you've got, and then of course you've got, you know, the fact that the 0.9 diagnosis code is not well liked by any adjudication system in most cases. I mean, there are certain times when that is the only thing you can do and you're stuck with it. But even then, it's one you want to try and avoid, those 0.9s, or the unspecifieds. So there are a number of other erectile dysfunction codes. You've got your entire 52.3 series, which are erectile dysfunctions because of surgeries, post-procedural erectile dysfunctions. Those may be covered because they are caused by an unknown event, if you will. And so it changes the benefit to, you know, kind of that preventative side or that patient living side to much more of a causal side. And that may be true of your 52.2 or your 52.0 codes, which, you know, 01, 02, and 03. So as you look at providing services to erectile dysfunction patients, it is important to be specific on your diagnosis codes, without a doubt. And that may help with some things, but there are others. that they may not, that it may be a non-covered service. And the only way that we have found to really keep a good eye on this is to check your payer bulletins and your payer websites ahead of time for your biggest payers. It's hard to keep track of all of them, especially those of you who have like 50 different insurance companies that you keep track of. But pay attention to the upfront rules if you can. And then knowing that erectile dysfunction codes are often not covered, I might change my collection policies up front and get a little bit more of the money in place and deal with the refunds if they in fact are covered. So that's another protection tool that you can get through. So that the answer to that question is there's not always a diagnosis change that you have available to you that can get those covered. But there are some, and ultimately, you know, it boils back down into you need to make sure that you're doing a little bit better job on your ICD-10 coding. You know, we kind of assumed that ICD-10 coding, and over the years, we've been able to get away with looser definitions for ICD-10. And those are tightening up. I mean, they're going in. Scott mentioned at the top that there a few minutes ago that we're seeing these changes for the excludes one and excludes two changes, or the includes side of the equation. So they're paying more attention to the ICD-10 instructions. And the one that I see outside of erectile dysfunction that's very common with denials is your bladder cancer. You know, C67.9 is not a workable diagnosis. How do you have a diagnosed bladder cancer and not know where it is kind of the general thought behind it. And then moving towards history of codes, because those also are covered for surveillance cystoscopy in most cases. So understanding those things. And then the last thing I'll add in all of this before we open up for another couple of questions is this is a real process issue in that your billing staff, your folks that are working the AR, need to have the freedom and the support to talk to the clinical staff about what's not working. I mean, you need to close that loop. You need to meet regularly, clinical staff and the AR team, to find out what's working, what's not, and so you don't end up with a compounded problem. You're better off dealing with these issues up front, because that AR fix in the back end has gotten tougher and tougher.
Sounds like what you're saying is that it is important to use the most specific ICD-10 code, no matter what the disease process is, whether that's ED or bladder cancer. And number two, it is important to know what the specific payer covers for that specific patient, what plan that patient has, what does that plan cover?
Right. That's both very true.
So tactically, this is a very simple question, but not so simple in execution. How does a practice determine what coverage the patient has before the patient is seen?
So that is a tough one to look for. So, you know, the one, so there's a couple of different tactics that I would tell you. So first of all, I would tell you that you don't have to learn everything about the payer. What you actually need to learn about the payer is how it affects what you do. So you want to focus your research on what the payers are asking for and doing on those services that you routinely provide. So that's number one. Focus your research as you deal with your payers. Second, focus on those payers that are most important to you. You know, again, if you see a patient one time, or an insurance patient with a particular insurance that isn't something you see very often, that's a stop and go thing that's really tough to go through. So, you know, that may be an area where you change your collection policies up front. The other thing that I'll mention, and one of the things that we spend a lot of time with our with our revenue cycle clients, so those folks that we're billing for, is helping them understand what comes back from the payer in the response to their eligibility. A lot of times people stop at the very top of that eligibility form. There's a lot of information if you continue to drill down to figure out, A, which payer is actually the payer. You know, you may have a subsidiary of a plan, and figuring out which plan needs to be billed is buried in that further down read. Now, some of the electronic or some of the practice management systems do a better job of serving that information up than others. But understanding how to read those eligibility forms is also a big tool in finding that out and finding out, you know, not stopping at the first copay, but finding out what the specialty copay is, finding out where their deductibles are. All of those things are reasonable approaches that ultimately help in all of this. And then the last one, I alluded to this a couple of times. Don't be afraid to overcollect. You know, obviously you'd like to make sure that you're not writing refund checks or refunding the credit card, because that is some work. But with everybody's high deductibles and the fact that a lot of their stuff is not covered for your younger patients for sure, those folks are probably going to end up paying the majority of the bill for most of your encounters. So don't be afraid to collect up front before you get the services or give the services.
So the question is, how do you determine how much you need to collect? That's the question.
Yeah. So that's a tougher one to look at. I mean, obviously if you can get an idea of where your fee schedules are, again, for your top payers, and know what that amount is by payer, that's the ideal. But the perfect is the enemy of the good. So in those circumstances, most practices will set their collection rates at the relatively expected amount. Maybe it's Medicare's payment, because that's an easy one to grab, and so you're only using a little bit, or 1.5 times Medicare, or 2. In the end, it depends on where your market is. I mean, geographically, everybody's got a different amount of managed care, and your payers behave a little differently, your contract's a little different. But when you're using the shotgun approach to basically run the practice, then you need to come up with a reasonable number that is based on some type of general analysis. So say most of your contracts are 130% of Medicare, collect 130%, 120%, whatever it is, as their co-payment upfront. Now, you can find some of that in the pre-adjudication tools that are out there as well. So there are ways to contact the payer or poke the payer websites and find out what you're expected to be paid or what the expected is paid. If you've got the staff and the ability to do that, that's a better way to go. And ultimately, if you can figure out somebody that can provide that information to serve up to your front desk, that's an important thing. Or even better, try and collect that before the patient comes in. You know, do use the phone. Try and keep your front desk cleaner, if you will, that there you've got all that information ahead of time. That would be the ideal office flow. So there are a lot of tools. There's a lot of things you can do, but you've got to navigate it through where your practice is and how you can, you know, what resources you have available to you to do all these things.
It sounds like what you're saying is that you want to apply what's called Pareto's principle. 80% of the time, 20% of the 80% of the work is the majority of your patients the type of patients that you see, and I think the analogies is 20% of the patients provide you with 80% of the revenue, or 20% of the payers provide you with 80% of the revenue, and so you need to figure out the fee schedule for that 20%. You don't have to figure it out for all your pay, all 50 of your payers, figure it out for the 20% of the payers that you commonly see most of your patients from, and then come up with that table where you know what their fee schedule is, and then figure out for a particular ICD-10 or CPT, what is the coverage for that particular plan for that patient. And that's how you determine how much to collect at the time of service. And then using the online payer tools may be helpful in determining, well, how much the deductible has been met. What is the co-insurance? What is the co-payment for that particular visit? Unfortunately, it does take work. You can do, as you say, the shotgun approach and just generalize the amount for this particular plan, or you can go deep dive into this particular patient's visit if you have the resources to figure that out. And I will tell you, the majority of the negative online reviews come from two things. Number one, not knowing how much things cost and you get a surprise bill at the end. And number two, time. You're wasting patients' time. So money being one of them, it would behoove us to give the patients an estimate of how much the visit today is going to cost, how much the cystoscopy, how much the Eurocuff, how much the transrectal ultrasound will cost before the visit. That way you can have happier patients and better online reviews.
So well said. I've got one final question regarding this question, and then I think we'll wrap it up here. My final question is to you, John. It's a tactical question. Going back to the question number two, if you do find something like an unspecified code getting denied, how do you communicate that to your staff? Is it a formal, informal type communication? And I'll get the second thing is, what if your staff finds something that they want to communicate to you? How do you do that? What does that work in? How does that work in your office?
So, well, first of all, I don't do the billing. I have Krista, who helps me with billing. She does all the billing, and she tells me which codes are being denied. She tells me, for instance, if Aetna is automatically downcoding my E&Ms, she tells me that an ITIN procedure that I performed in the ASC is being denied the professional payment. So that, first of all, communication is key, right? So you have to communicate with the coding and billing staff, and the coding and billing staff who are listening to this podcast, please do not be afraid to tell your docs. I love hearing from Krista. I want to know what games the payers are playing. Knowing that the games that they're playing and her educating me on what they're looking for. For instance, BPH. If I'm doing a cystoscopy on a BPH patient, she tells me preemptively every single day that I'm doing a cysto for BPH. She tells me what the payer criteria are for some of the minimally invasive procedures that I may perform, ITIN, UroLift, et cetera. So she will tell me, for instance, prostate has to be under 100 grams, no evidence of hematuria, no evidence of active urinary tract infection, no incontinence. So by her letting me know what is needed, I will literally document that in my encounter after the cystoscopy for that modifier 25 E&M, so that the predetermination or the pre-authorization for whatever surgery that I recommend for the patient will not get denied. It really just streamlines the workflow. And the other thing is, for the docs who are listening, you want to praise, you want to encourage, say, thank you. I really appreciate you telling me these rules, Krista, about the games that the payers are playing. So number one, communication. Number two, for the docs, encourage that communication.
Yeah, that's good.
So I want to add one other thing really quickly is the other part of this. I mean, John, you've worked with Krista for a while and you educate her on how to look for things as well. And, you know, that's the other piece of that needs to go into place is not just the praise, but the support so that your billers are actually telling you the actual rules and what's there. And they know that the information they're giving you is correct, is well researched. So it needs to be a dialogue, not just a feed. And you know, you learn, trust is earned over time, but don't be afraid to invest in that education for your billing staff. That is a huge portion of all of this.
So here's, I'll give you an example. I recently did some ITINs in a surgery center, and we used an unlisted code. Krista did not put in box 19 about which crosswalk code to index that to. And so we are dealing with that denied claim right now. And it's really a three-way communication. Number one, you have the vendor who should clearly let us know how or recommend how we should consider billing. Number two, it's up to me, really. The codes and the bills and the claims are going out under my NPI. So it is ultimately my responsibility because she didn't put the crosswalk code in box 19. Really, it's my responsibility. She's not the one who's going to go to jail if I defrauded Medicare or there's a thought or implication of a fraud. She's not the one going to jail. She's not the one getting fined. I am. So I have to understand these rules. I need to know. And so really, it's my responsibility that the claim did not go out cleanly. And so understand these rules, but then it's not really ultimately the billing staff's code. It is also partly my responsibility.
Yep. All right. Okay. Let's wrap this episode up here. I do want to remind you that, as John had mentioned earlier, the Urology Advanced Coding and Reimbursement Seminar registration is open, and we are going to be in Las Vegas December 1st and 2nd, and in New Orleans January 26th and 27th, 2024. You can go to the episode page, which is prsnetwork.com/168 for episode 168, and also you can find some information on the Thriving Urology Practice Facebook group. I think John has a special code for his members to sign up as well. So you can get registered in a bunch of different ways. All right, let's get some final thoughts. John, let's go with Mark first. Mark, final thoughts.
So we've talked a lot about coordination, communication, underlying all these specific topics today, and process. And, you know, those three things are a must. I mean, there's just no way around it. You want to try as you're going through all this and all the pressures in your day to day. It's important to take some time to address all of those issues and then execute on your plans to make that happen. It's definitely something that when I go into practices and give them, you know, coding talks or we're doing consulting work with them, you know, they always go out gung-ho, like, yeah, we're definitely going to have more meetings. It's more important to have all this stuff. And then the day-to-day, you know, swallows all those great plans. So, you know, plan and execute. Don't just plan, execute.
John, final thoughts.
At the time of this recording, we're about a week or so away from Halloween. Halloween is scary to some people. The ghouls, goblins, ghosts. And what that means is we are afraid of the unknown. Coding and billing does not have to be the unknown. You can get a grasp of what is going on in your practice by understanding some of these very basic rules that you'll learn and apply throughout the rest of your practice careers. For the coders and billers who are listening, you've earned your certifications. You've learned these basic rules. The changes are going to be incremental, and it's going to be very easy to understand. For the urologist, come on, 4 years of med school, five, six years of residency. This is easy stuff. This is something that anybody can do. And it's literally going to immediately translate to a better bottom line by understanding and applying these rules appropriately and accurately.
Well said. Very well said. All right. We want to end this here, and I want to once again, say thank you to ModMed for supporting this episode. If you're in the market for a practice management or EHR solution, please visit modmed.com/PRS network for some specials they offer to our audience. That's all for today. Take us out, John.
And I truly mean it when I say this. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time. Please take care of yourself, take care of each other, and happy coding.
Thank you for listening to the Urology Coding and Reimbursement Podcast, where we help urologists and their staff maximize income and efficiencies so there's time and energy for patient care and a happy life. Special thanks to Carl Painter for the music today. You can find his music on Spotify under his record label, The Juicery.